Well, we've been studying the book of Luke for the last, 9 months or so. And so we've seen essentially all of Christ's life from his birth up now through the very end of his life. We've seen his ministry, the different opportunities that the Lord gave him on this earth to share the message of the gospel with people, to proclaim his own deity to people. And we're towards the end of his life now, and tonight, or this morning, we're going to consider really the last events of his life before his death. The betrayal, his denial, the trials leading up to his crucifixion in Luke 22, starting in verse 39. In the parallel account in Matthew 27, Pilate was the ultimate authority from the Roman government in that area. And at the end of the trial with Pilate, he said this to the people. He says this, it said, "The governor said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release for you?' And they said, 'Barabbas.'" They could choose between Christ and Barabbas. "And Pilate said to them, 'Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?'" What shall I do with Jesus? Pilate, who was the Roman governor of Judea, was faced with the decision of, "I've got this man Christ here. What should I do with him? Should I take him and hand him over to the people who want him to be killed? Should I do what's right and set him free knowing that he's innocent?" Yes, he was faced in a real way with, what do I do with Jesus? I have the power of this man's life in my hands. What should I do with him? You guys, for each of us, that same question is just as important as it was for Pilate. What will you and what will I do with Jesus? Now, Jesus' life does not hang in the balance of our decision, does it? None of us sit over Jesus with the authority to have him condemned to death or to set him free. You guys, but our life hangs in the balance of how we respond to that. What will you do with Jesus? How will you respond to Jesus? You guys, today we're going to see three different examples, three different people who had seen a lot of Jesus' life and ministry. They'd seen Jesus in at the heights of his ministry and his popularity. They'd seen him at the depths of his personal despair. They'd gotten to know him, know who he was, what he stood for, what God had revealed him to be. And they were faced with the choice, what am I now going to do with Jesus? Unfortunately, the three examples we're going to see this morning are three wrong ways that we should answer that question. And you guys, as we consider their examples, I think we'll be challenged personally with how we respond, how we treat Jesus. Let's start in Luke 22, just at the scene, starting in verse 39. Follow along with me as I read. It says this, He came out and proceeded, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. If you remember from last week, Jesus had just celebrated the Passover meal with his disciples for the last time. And so after that, celebrating that meal together, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And when he arrived at that place, verse 40 says, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." Jesus, as he's at this point in life, is looking forward to the anguish of the cross. And he knows what's before him, and he's saying, "God, if there's any other way to accomplish this without me going to the cross, I'd be all for it." And he says, "Yet not my will, but yours be done." Verse 43 says, "An angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he was praying fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground." Just a picture of how much agony and anguish he was in at this point. Verse 45, "When he arose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow and said to them, 'Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you may not enter into temptation.'" And verse 47 says that while he was still speaking, behold, a crowd came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. The first example for us to consider this morning is, will you treat him like Judas? Will you treat Jesus like Judas? It tells us in this verse that Judas came up to kiss him. Who remembers? Why was Judas going to kiss him? Say hi to him? No. I've heard the story before lots of times, haven't you? He was going to betray him, wasn't he? That's what it says. Jesus said to him in verse 48, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" You guys, the religious leaders, you remember, Judas had gone to them and he'd offered his services to betray Jesus. Why do they need somebody to betray Jesus? Why was that helpful to the religious leaders? You remember from last week's passage? Buddy? How is Judas being helpful by betraying him? Look back at chapter 21, or first part of chapter 22, verse 4. It says that Judas went away and discussed with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money, so he consented and began seeking an opportunity to betray him to them apart from the crowd. You remember, this was Passover time of year. All kinds of Jews would come to Jerusalem to celebrate the feast. Crowds were incredibly large at that time in Jerusalem. And the religious leaders knew if they walked up to Jesus in the middle of the temple, in the middle of the day, and they arrested him, it could cause a stir with the people. And so Judas was their way into Jesus' life, where they could find him at an opportune time apart from the crowd, when they could get him when he was away from everybody else and quietly arrest him and take him off. And so Judas had gone and he'd agreed to do that for them. Look what Judas did, verse 49. When those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, "Lord, shall we strike with the sword?" And one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus said, "Stop, no more of this." And he touched his ear and healed him. And Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come against him, "Have you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour in the power of darkness are yours." Again, Jesus saying, you could have arrested me in the temple, but no, you chose to do it now apart from the crowds and in darkness, because that's symbolic of what it is that you are doing. You're serving the prince of darkness. You guys, why did Judas do that? Judas, one of the 12 disciples, why would he, at the end of Jesus' life and ministry, why would he choose to say, instead of following Jesus, I'm going to go and I'm going to betray Jesus. I'm going to help his enemies. I'm going to help those who want to kill him do it and do it quietly so they can get away with it. What would cause Judas to do that? Well, the Bible doesn't speak a ton about Judas, but it does give us insight a little bit into his character. And we know that many of the disciples, when they first signed on to follow Jesus, did they really understand what was involved in that? Any of the disciples? No. Even recently in Luke, we've seen that they didn't understand that Jesus was going to the cross. They didn't understand why Jesus ultimately had come and that he ultimately had to die. They thought they were following the Messiah in a political sense, didn't they? They thought Messiah is going to come and he's going to overthrow Rome and we're going to be his right-hand men. You know, we're going to be the guys who've been with Jesus from the beginning, and that's the place to be. If you're with a new leader, you know, you've been with him from the beginning, we're going to be in positions of power and authority. You guys, but at some point, as the disciples followed Jesus, things began to click for them. And they understood more and more of who Jesus was and why he had come. And ultimately, the other 11 came to a point where they understood that Jesus had to die. And they accepted that and they embraced that and they spent their life proclaiming that, but not Judas. You guys, when Judas at some point realized that Jesus was not going to be the political leader he had hoped, at some point he realized that and he realized that this is not going to work out the way I expected it to. Judas probably originally thought, I'll follow Jesus, he'll set up his kingdom, and I will get to reign with Jesus. Pretty good deal for Judas, right? By this point, he's realized that's not happening. And at some point, Judas put that together and he realized that, man, I just need to get out of this whatever I can. Look over at John chapter 12 real quick. John 12. We see a little picture of Judas's character midway through Jesus' life and ministry. And we see that already at this point, and possibly earlier, maybe from the beginning, although I don't necessarily think so, but we don't really know. Judas has already begun to say, look, I'm not really following Jesus. I'm just trying to get out of this what I can. You remember the story in John chapter 12 where Mary came and anointed Jesus with the expensive perfume. It says in verse 3 that Mary took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor people?" Now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Judas was the treasurer for the disciples. They didn't all carry money. When somebody gave him money, Judas would take that and he would hold it. And if they needed to go buy food, he would be the one to do that. And he said, hey, we could sell this perfume for lots of money and we could give it to the poor. But really, Judas was thinking, we could sell that for lots of money and we could put it in the money box and I could take some of it. Yes, that's what Judas was thinking. He realized, look, following Jesus is not really getting me anywhere except that I'm the treasurer, and so I get some of the money. I can steal some of the money. Yeah, so Judas had decided that he wasn't really going to follow Jesus for the right reasons. He was just getting out of it what he could. You know, the scary thing, though, back in Luke 22, is that the other disciples didn't know that Judas was that way. Judas did a good job, didn't he, of playing the part, of living out that role. Look at verse 21 of chapter 22, again, from earlier. It says, but behold, Jesus said, the hand of the one betraying me is with mine on the table, for the Son of Man is going as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. And the disciples began to discuss among themselves which one of them it might be who was going to do this thing. At the very Last Supper, the disciples, it wasn't like Jesus said, hey, somebody's going to betray me. And they all said, it's Judas. It wasn't like they said, you know, somebody's going to betray me. And they all knew right away, yeah, Judas, you know, he always walks at the back of the group. You know, he never really talks to people about Jesus. He never really participates with us. He's kind of the oddball out of the disciples. No, he blended in with the rest of them. And they were honestly asking themselves, who's it going to be? They didn't know that Judas was in this for the wrong reasons. He was very good at blending in with the other disciples. And yet he was following Jesus not to follow Jesus. He was following him for his own personal gain. You guys, that's one way that you and I can respond to Jesus, isn't it? We can treat him like Judas did. We can follow him for a while and then ultimately turn our backs on him because we're not getting out of it what we want. You guys, when the personal benefit to us is exhausted, we can turn away from Christ and go our own way. You guys, that's essentially what Judas did when he betrayed him. He realized, look, things are going downhill with Jesus, and now's a good time to get out. If I stick with Jesus a little while longer, Jesus is probably going to get killed, and it's probably not going to be real pretty for his disciples, and so I don't want to be one anymore. And here's a chance to get out by betraying him and even make a little extra money on the side. Guys, I hope that none of us will treat Jesus like Judas did. Following him for a while, playing the game for a while, but then when we're not getting what we want, walk away. You guys, maybe that's you. Maybe you're here this morning. You're involved in our church simply because of what it benefits you. Maybe it's in your relationship with your parents. Maybe you know your parents want you to be here. And your parents want you to follow Christ. And so you do some of what is right simply because you know it pleases my parents. It helps me to get something with them. It helps them to leave me alone and not worry about me so much. And so I will do that while it gets me that. But then some point down the road when you don't need that anymore, you will go your own way. Or maybe you're here because of the relationships, the friendships that you have here, and you do things because you enjoy the friends here, and you want them to think well of you, or the leaders, or whatever it is. If you're here for any reason, and you're following Jesus for any reason, other than because he is worthy of that, and you believe in him, and you trust him, and you desire to live for him, you guys, at some point, you will possibly be like Judas. And you will realize that there is no longer the personal benefit to you that you once found. And you will walk away. You guys, that obviously is a very, very wrong way to treat Jesus, isn't it? But that's how Judas treated him. Judas, who followed Jesus for years, decided, I've had enough. I've got all I can get out of this relationship, and I'm done with it. I'm going to walk away. You guys, would that would not be the case for you or for I. You guys, so will you be like Judas, playing the game for a while, but then when you're not getting what you want, walk away? Secondly, will you treat Jesus like Peter did? Like Peter did. Come back at Luke 22, verse 54. Judas betrayed him. The officers came. They knew who Jesus was. They took him. Having arrested him, verse 54 says, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest. But Peter was following at a distance. After they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter was sitting among them. Again, you're familiar with the story. They took Jesus. It was nighttime. Nighttime, it was illegal to have a trial for the court of Israel. And so they took him instead to the high priest's house, and they had sort of an informal trial with him. It was probably actually the father-in-law of the high priest. If you read some of the other accounts, you can get a little confusing. You see a guy named Annas and Caiaphas. The one was actually the high priest. One was an old guy who had a lot of authority. And so they're sometimes both referred to that way. And so they took him to this house, and they began to interrogate Jesus, and Peter followed from a distance. There was apparently a courtyard between those two houses. And so Peter was there with the servant sitting around the fire. And verse 56 says, a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the firelight and looking intently at him, said, this man was with him too. Possibly it was a servant girl who'd been in the garden, who knows. But she recognized Peter and said, hey, haven't you been with Jesus? Peter's response, he denied it, saying, woman, I do not know him. Went on, verse 58, a little later, another saw him and said, You are one of them too. But Peter said, man, I am not. After about an hour had passed, another man began to insist, saying, certainly this man also is with him, for he is a Galilean too. Galileans talk differently. That was from up north. You know, it'd be like if somebody came from Minnesota or something down here. We'd be like, whoa, you're not from here, right? You know, we'd recognize them. And so they recognize that Peter talks differently than the people from around here. Jesus was from Galilee. And so, man, you seem like you were with him. Peter said, man, I do not know what you are talking about. And immediately while he was still speaking, a rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he told him, before a rooster crows today, you will deny me three times. You guys, Peter, who had become a leader of the church, denied Christ these three times. He was faced with an opportunity to speak up about Christ, to align himself with Christ, to speak the truth about Christ to others, and three times he failed, didn't he? He denied him. He chose not to identify himself with Jesus. You guys, I think this is probably the easiest one for us to identify, isn't it? So easy to do that. What are some ways that you could be like Peter did, like Peter denied Jesus here? What are some situations in your life that you've been in where that could be true for you? Anybody? Josh?
Failing to speak up, like at work, when you're talking about stuff
they shouldn't. Okay. Yeah, failing to speak up about Christ at work? Absolutely. Is work and school, maybe it's just an opportunity where they're talking about religious things and you'd have a chance to speak up and say, no, I believe in Jesus. Maybe it'll be in a couple weeks when the movie The Da Vinci Code comes out. People watch it and talking about what it says about Jesus. And instead of taking that opportunity to say, no, that's not true, this is what the Bible really says, just sit there. Maybe it's a time when other people are talking about being Christians and maybe people are laughing at them. And instead of you saying, hey, I'm a Christian too, I follow Christ as well, you just sit there and you pretend like you're not. You guys, any chance that we have to speak about Christ and we fail to take that, we're essentially being like Peter. Any chance that we have to identify ourselves with Christ, to say, hey, I'm a follower of Christ, and we fail to take that, we choose not to speak up for whatever reason, you guys, we're essentially being like Peter. You guys, that's how Peter treated Jesus. And for Peter, thankfully, this was the exception, wasn't it? Peter was a bold guy. In John chapter 21, after Jesus rose from the dead, he restored Peter to himself. He was forgiven for the denials that he had. And in Acts chapter 2, you remember Peter was back in Jerusalem, and he proclaimed the sermon at Pentecost, and 3,000 people were saved, confronting the people with their sin, with the fact that they crucified Christ. You guys, Peter learned to speak up for Jesus, didn't he? One of my favorite examples, look over at Acts chapter 4 real quick. Peter and John were arrested and they were brought in before the religious leaders and they threatened him, saying, don't talk about Jesus anymore. Peter and John, verse 19 of Acts 4, said, whether it's right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge, for we cannot stop speaking about what we have seen and heard. Was that Peter on that night when he denied him? Nope, he didn't have too hard of a time stopping to speak about Christ, did he? But no, he matured and he understood, man, I need to speak forth the truth of Christ. I need to identify with Christ. In 1 Peter 3:15, Peter wrote, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Yes, that's the Peter who denied Christ, who failed to speak up, saying, always be ready to speak up about Christ when anybody asks. Peter learned. Yes, well, why on this occasion did Peter deny Christ? I think there's some clues back earlier in chapter 22. Look back at chapter 22, verse 31. It's interesting that before Peter denied Christ, there's some not-so-subtle hints about it, but also some subtle things about what Peter could have done possibly to help avoid that. Chapter 22, verse 31, Jesus was talking to Simon, to Peter, after the Last Supper. And he said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. But Peter said to him, Lord, with you I am ready to go both to prison and to death. Wow, that's pretty bold, Peter, isn't he? Before Christ is arrested, Peter says, Jesus, I'm going with you to prison and death, man. I'm there. If they take you and they arrest you, they can take me too. They kill you, they can take me and kill me. Kill me too. Jesus says, I say to you, Peter, the rooster will not crow today until you have denied me three times that you know me. Because Peter said, no, I'm never going to do that. I'm going to stand with you, Jesus. I'm not going to deny you. Because Peter was proud, wasn't he? He thought, there's no way I would deny my Lord. And you guys, if you and I want to be like Peter and deny Christ and fail to take those opportunities, the place to start is by being proud and thinking that you won't. If you go out this week thinking, man, I would never do what Peter did, you will. If you go out thinking, man, I always take opportunities to share Christ, you won't. Yes, but if you humbly recognize, like Peter failed to, that you are prone to deny Christ, that you are prone to not stand for Him, to lack boldness, then that's going to lead to the second thing that we see, and that's a prayerful attitude. You guys, in the garden, Jesus had encouraged the disciples. He said, pray that you may not enter into temptation. I think He was talking about the upcoming challenges they were about to face. Pray that you will honor Christ through the midst of the things that are coming. And did they do that? No, they took a power nap, didn't they? They slept. Because they failed to understand their need. Peter failed to understand his need for Christ, and so he failed to pray about those things. And as a result, just a few verses later, he's denying Christ. Yes, so Peter was proud, and he failed to pray, asking God for the strength to not fall into those temptations. And as a result, he failed to be bold for Christ. Yes, so for us, if we are humble, if we understand, God, it's hard to speak the truth about Christ to people. And I don't do that well on my own strength. And you cry out each morning, God, help me to take these opportunities. Help me not to miss a chance to speak about Christ. Help me not to miss a chance to identify myself with Christ. If you do those things, then when those situations come, you won't be like Peter. You won't deny Christ. Okay, so what should we do with Jesus? Well, will we treat Him like Judas did? Will we treat Him like Peter did? Will we believe in Him and follow Him and yet choose not to speak for Him on some occasions? I hope not. And then lastly, thirdly there, will you treat Him like Pilate did? Like Pilate did. Continuing through the story, look at verse 63. They took Jesus. They're holding Him in custody. Verse 63 says that they were mocking Him and beating Him, and they blindfolded Him and were asking Him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who hit you? And they were saying many other things against Him. When it was day, verse 66, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led Him away to their council chamber, saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. But He said, if I tell you, you will not believe. Essentially what you have there is they had the evening or the nighttime sort of informal trial at the high priest's house, and then they assembled the Sanhedrin, the ruling body of the Jews. About 70 people on the Sanhedrin, and they had a more of a formal trial, a religious trial of the Jews seeking to condemn Jesus. Verse 70, they said, "Are you the Son of God?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "What further need do we have of his testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." So they found him guilty. They said he's blaspheming God. He's claiming to be God. But unfortunately for the Jews, they were not ultimately in charge at that point, were they? The Romans were ultimately the ones who were in charge. And so the Jewish ruling body said Jesus is guilty, but they had to take him to the Roman leaders in order to get permission to execute him, in order to kill him. And so chapter 23, verse 1, it says that the whole body, all 70 of these religious leaders, it'd be like the Senate, getting out of their chambers and going up and bringing this man before Pilate. And they began to accuse him. And notice what they say. Pilate, again, was the governor, the Roman official over that particular region of Israel. He was the ultimate authority that Rome had set up there. And so they take him to Pilate. And they say these things: "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Yes, had Jesus done those things? Was he forbidding them to pay taxes to Caesar? Is that what Jesus had said? No, Jesus said the opposite, didn't he? He said, "Give it to Caesar." Yes, but they're trying to make up these charges that would make it sound like Jesus is somehow bad for Rome. And Pilate asked him, verse 3, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "It is as you say." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no guilt in this man." Now, there you go. You got Pilate, the governor. He says, "I find no guilt in this man. This man is innocent." Now, I know some of you maybe don't have like law degrees and stuff, but you're pretty sharp. So at that point, Pilate says, "This man is innocent." Pilate is the ultimate authority from Rome. What should have happened at this point? Put your head together and think. Probably should have let him go, right? End of trial. He's innocent, right? No guilt. He's done. But that's not what happened. Verse 5. They kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." And this is when we begin to see that Pilate is essentially a spineless jellyfish. You know, he's scared, he's afraid, he's the ruler, but he has no backbone, no desire to do what's right. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. Interesting, you say, big deal, who cares if he was a Galilean? Well, when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also in Jerusalem at that time. Here's where it gets interesting. Jesus had done ministry up in Galilee, up north. Pilate is the governor of the southern part. Herod is the governor up north. Pilate and Herod don't really like each other at this point too much, just so you know. And so Pilate is like, Jesus is kind of a problem here. I don't know what to do. I think he's innocent. The Jews want me to kill him. I'm kind of torn here. If I kill him, the Jews are happy. But he's innocent, I shouldn't do that. And so he says, Jesus was up in Galilee. Herod is the governor in Galilee. This could become Herod's problem. And so he sent him to Herod, who was in Jerusalem for the feast at that time. So he's thinking, I'll just get rid of Jesus. I'll pass him off to somebody else. I won't make a decision about Jesus. Pretty spineless guy, wasn't he? Pretty pathetic. We can be like him, though. Verse 8, Herod gets Jesus. Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he'd wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. So Herod's like, hey, great, send Jesus over. I've wanted to see this Jesus guy. I've heard about him. Maybe he'll do something impressive, you know, he'll multiply my food for me or do something. Who knows? So Herod's excited. He questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. Jesus didn't respond, and the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. So Herod decided with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, they dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. An interesting verse 12, now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for they had been enemies with each other. So Herod says, I don't really know what to do with him either. So I'll put him in one of my old robes and send him back to Pilate, and Pilate can worry about him. Because after all, we're in Jerusalem, and it's Pilate's problem. Pretty good guys, aren't they? Good government officials we see there. So Pilate gets Jesus back. He's like, didn't work. Pilate summoned the chief priest, verse 13, and the rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. And behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him." He brings together the chief priests, the rulers, that ruling body again, but also all the people. He calls together anybody who wants to come to hear his ruling about Jesus. And he says, "You've came and you've said that Jesus has done all these things, that he leads the people to rebellion. And I tell you, I talked to this guy, I examined him, and he's innocent." That's again Pilate's verdict. He says, verse 15, "No, nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us, and behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I sent him to Herod, and Herod agreed. Yeah, he hadn't really done anything wrong. We'll beat him, send him back. I don't know what to do with him." Pilate says, "Therefore I will punish him and release him." Punish him for what? I don't know. Just make the people happy, right? He's like, "Well, he hadn't really done anything bad, but you don't like him, so I'll beat him up a little bit, and then we'll let him go. I'll try to appease you." But they cried out, or verse 17, says, "Now he was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner." Again, you're familiar with this. Custom at that time was for Rome to release a prisoner to the Jews to help make them happy, make their feast for them. Verse 18, "But they cried out together, saying, 'Away with this man, and release for us Barabbas.' He was one who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city and for murder." So the people begin to cry out, "No, give us Barabbas instead." Barabbas was obviously a very bad guy, right? Jesus, obviously innocent. Pilate knows that. Pilate knows Barabbas is obviously a very bad guy. They say, "We want Barabbas." Notice verse 20. "But Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again. But they kept on calling out, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' And he said to them a third time, 'Why, what evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore I will punish him and release him.'" You can picture the scene of Pilate as he's addressing the people and saying, "No, he's innocent." And the people keep crying out, "No, crucify him, kill him," as the religious leaders stir them up. And Pilate again, "No, he hasn't done anything wrong. I'm just going to punish him and release him." But verse 23 says, "They were insistent with loud voices, asking that he be crucified, and their voices began to prevail." And Pilate pronounced sentence that their demand be granted, and he released the man they were asking for, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, but he delivered Jesus to their will. You guys, Pilate knew that Jesus was innocent. And yet he chose to say, "No, we're going to allow him to be crucified." It's interesting, if you read some of the other gospel accounts, it seems to indicate that Pilate understood more than just Jesus' innocence as well. Pilate had a pretty good understanding of who Jesus was, I think. He knew who Jesus claimed to be, that he claimed to be the Son of God. And he had some understanding of what that meant. You guys, Pilate's right response not only would have been to say, "Jesus is innocent and I'm going to free him," but to say, "Jesus is Lord and I'm going to follow him." You guys, Pilate, I think, understood enough about Jesus that he should have at least brought him in and said, "Look, tell me the truth, man, about who you are. I want to know and I want to believe." That should have been Pilate's response. But Pilate didn't have the guts to do that, and he didn't even have the guts to say, "No, this man is innocent. We're not going to kill him." You guys, he should have known so much more and done so much more with Christ, and yet he did nothing but condemn him to death. He should have repented and believed in Christ, but instead he chose to join in his murder. You guys, why did Pilate do that? Why was Pilate willing to say, "This innocent man I will condemn to death. This man who claims to be the Son of God, and I really think he is, instead of following him, I'm going to allow these people to kill him"? Why did Pilate do that? Well, it's pretty clear here, isn't it, that he feared the people. Verse 23 said that their voices began to prevail. Pilate couldn't control the people, and they kept crying out, "Crucify him, crucify him," and he's trying to respond to them and trying to convince them that they don't need to do that to Christ, and yet they won't listen to him, and so he finally just says, "No, I'll do it." Yes, it was very important for Pilate's job that the people not be upset with him. Pilate was the Roman governor in that region. He was not elected to that position. He was appointed by the Roman government. And you know what the Roman government cared about Pilate's job? You know what they wanted Pilate to do? Get money, collect taxes, and keep the people kind of quiet. Keep the people from revolting against Rome, and keep the money coming in, and you keep your job, Pilate. You guys, what were some of the perks you think that came with Pilate's job, being a Roman governor? A lot of power, authority, money, all those things were tied to Pilate's job, which his job was tied to the people being somewhat happy. They weren't really ever going to like Pilate, but they would at least be appeased by Pilate. And so Pilate was faced with a choice that day. Do I do what is right with Jesus? Do I allow this innocent man to go free? And do I follow this man who is God? Or do I keep my job? Do I keep the people happy? Do I keep my position of power and authority and wealth? Pilate was faced with that choice, and that's why he was faced with the question, what do I do with Jesus? Do I do what's right, what he deserves, or do I go with what's best in my mind for me? You guys, Pilate made his choice because he feared the people, because he loved his position. He chose to send Christ to death. You guys, Pilate tried to kind of embrace Jesus. He tried to proclaim the truth. In the other accounts, it says that he took a bowl out and he washed his hands and said, hey, I'm innocent of Christ. You guys killed him. He tried to make it out like he was on Christ's side, but he wasn't willing to really do that. In a sense, he tried to kind of live for Christ. He even put a sign that said King of the Jews above him, because I think he kind of believed that. And yet he wouldn't really follow Jesus because there were other things that he was living for. You guys, for you, what is it that keeps you from either embracing the truth about Christ or for living completely for him? Are you like Pilate? Do you fear other people? Would you follow Christ if it just wasn't for the opinions of others? If it wasn't for what other people thought of you, you would really be sold out for Jesus and you would really want to do all that he's commanded you to do? Guys, is it something else? Is it the pursuit of possessions, of things that keeps you from that? The desire for popularity, for stuff? What is it that holds you back from really committing yourself to Jesus, from really following Jesus? You guys, if you're placing your own personal gain ahead of Christ's glory, ahead of living for Christ, you are treating Christ exactly like Pilate did. You guys, that's what Pilate did to Jesus. He said, instead of doing what's right for Jesus, instead of freeing and following Jesus, I'm going to do what I think is best for me. You guys, don't be that way. You guys, you and I must answer that question, what will you do with Jesus? You guys, Judas had to answer that question, didn't he? For years he followed Jesus, he knew Jesus, and it came to a point where he had to decide, what am I going to do with Jesus? Am I going to follow him or am I going to run from him? Am I going to betray him and take what I can? You guys, Judas chose to play the game for a while, but then when he wasn't getting what he wanted, he walked away. And it cost him his eternity. Peter failed to speak up regarding Christ when presented with an opportunity. He chose not to identify himself with Christ. Ultimately, he was forgiven and he moved on, but he missed those chances to stand with Christ and to suffer with Christ. He missed those opportunities to see God glorified through him and possibly to see others come to know Jesus. And Pilate, he chose, again, his own personal gain, his position, the opinion of others over doing what was right for Jesus. Yes, I think for two of these men, for Judas and Pilate, their decision of what to do with Jesus on this point cost them their eternity, didn't it? You guys, ultimately, your answer to that question, what will I do with Jesus, is a matter of eternal consequence. If you answer that question wrongly, in the ultimate sense, you will spend an eternity apart from God. And yet, if you embrace Jesus, if you say, Jesus, claim to be God, I believe that He was God, that He lived a perfect life and He died and He calls me to repent and believe in Him. If you say, I will do that, the Bible says you'll be saved. You guys, but then it's not just in an ultimate sense, what will you do with Jesus that one time in order to be saved? But it's what will you do with Jesus every day? How will you treat Jesus today and tomorrow and this week and this summer? You guys, will you treat Jesus as He deserves to be treated? Will you live for Jesus as He deserves to be lived for? Or will you live for yourself, for the fear of others? You guys, what will you do with Jesus? Let's pray. Lord, I thank You for Your Word. I thank You for this passage that gives us not only the historical context of Christ's crucifixion, that tells the story that leads up to the cross, Lord, but it gives us the challenge of how will we respond to the man Jesus? How will we respond to the Son of God? Lord, will we respond as Judas and Peter and Pilate did, not giving Jesus the honor and glory that was due Him, not living for Jesus, not being bold and standing for Jesus, but instead living for themselves at that moment at least, Lord. I pray that each of us would take the time to evaluate our own lives this day. Lord, that we would consider how we have responded to Christ. If we have allowed other things in our life to take the place that Jesus deserves, Lord, like Pilate did. Or if we've just kind of played the game like Judas did, and when we're tired of it, when we're not getting anything else out of it, then we'll walk away. Or Lord, even if we're just like Peter, who are ultimately committed to Christ, and yet just miss opportunities to speak of His name, miss opportunities to identify ourselves with Him. Lord, help us to live for You this week. Lord, we love You. We thank You so much for this time. We commit the rest of our morning to You, and we commit ourselves to You in Christ's name.